The first matter on our calendar this morning is the case of DeSantiago versus the State of Nevada. It's case number 8-73. I'm Mr. Cornell on behalf of the appellant. Are you ready to proceed?
I am. Thank you very much, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, my name is Richard Cornell. I represent the appellant, Juan Marquez DeSantiago. In my reply brief, I admitted that I was guilty of a cardinal appellate sin, which is to say I put my weakest issue first in the opening brief. And the fact that Your Honors have granted Mr. DeSantiago oral argument, I see as a sign of conditional absolution. You'll forgive me that sin if I leave that issue on the brief, which I intend to do.
Mr. Cornell, before you proceed, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
If I don't run out, yes.
Very well.
Okay. But the other trial issues are ones that I hope to cover, and as I view this case, they all emanate from a common nucleus of facts, five in category. First, my client is one of a number of young Hispanic men minding his own business, drinking beer on a hot summer day, illegally, perhaps because they're underage, but that's what the facts are. Number two, although this group of young men, which I referenced in the brief as the Tiny and Looney Squad, because I didn't know how else to reference them, although they belong to different gangs, i.e. the Playboys, the Criminal Mexicans, the Infamous Soldiers, the WSK, they all get together and collectively they are not a gang. Number three, around the corner comes an honest-to-God gang, the Southside Locos, or the SSLs, seeking revenge against a miscreant who wasn't there, but the trial evidence is that these guys, the SSLs, didn't care for any young Hispanic male who wasn't part of their gang. And under any reasonable description of this fact, Arajas, or victim number one, is the initial deadly aggressor. He swings a baseball bat at Looney and hits Looney after Looney tells him to drop the bat. Category four, bullets from three different weapons are found at the scene. It is possible, and I underline possible, because the record is sort of confusing in this regard, that Barajas and or Anguiano, victim number two, were not hit by the appellant's weapon, but the defense was not that. The defense was not, quote-unquote, some other dude did it. The defense was that my client, who certainly did discharge one of the weapons, acted in self-defense or defense of others. And number five, my client did not live in that neighborhood. He was there looking for a girl. The reason he was armed, because he knew he was in SSL territory, and the last time he was in that territory, he got beat up in a Catholic church and at a relative's apartment, which frankly tells me this girl must have been awfully gorgeous. In any event, those are the five categories of facts, and they frame the three trial issues. First, why are we allowing in the gang affiliation of Tiny, Looney, and the rest of the squad at all? Now, there was no limiting instruction in that regard, and the state concedes that that was error, but argues that that error was harmless. However, had there been a limiting instruction, the jury would have been limited to consider that evidence to issues of motive, intent, common scheme or plan, identity, and so forth under 48045. None of that was a trial issue with respect to Tiny, Looney, who were really the key percipient witnesses, Dribbs, Puppet, and so forth. And the trial prosecutor's position, and you'll see this in his closing argument at pages 1908 through 14, 1920, and 1924 of the record, is arguing to the jury not to believe Tiny and Looney's trial testimony, not because they're gang members, not because they have a motive to lie on account of the fact that they're gang members, but because they gave prior inconsistent statements, allegedly, to the police relative to their trial testimony. So, the gang membership of these percipient witnesses, of these key witnesses, really is not relevant to any issue. Why is this evidence prejudicial? Because it's a gang case. Gang people are bad men, bad young men. These guys are all gangsters. Two people die, one person is seriously injured, and the only one on trial is my client. I submit to you that right there, that compendium errs. Allowing that evidence in and not giving a limiting instruction is sufficient to reverse. But I think probably the reason this court granted oral argument was the second issue, or the self-defense instruction issue.
Before you get into that, Mr. Cornell, I wanted to question you about the initial observations you made about the weapons, unless I misunderstood what you said. I understood from the record at 615, 828, 832, that the only shell casings found at the scene were the those that came from your client's gun, and that your gun was connected to all 12 shell casings found, according to the record at 518 and 1552. Is that correct?
My understanding, and certainly you know I never intend to mislead the court ever, is from Carrie Tibbett-Sheward's testimony, she being the forensic gun analyst, that most of the casings came from the gun discharged by my client, but there were casings from a different Glock that couldn't be matched up to my client's 9mm that were found, most specifically one in the Gonzalez apartment ahead of where Barajas was. There was also a casing from a .357 that was found. Now, we don't know whether those were discharged that day. The gang witnesses all denied that they had guns. But
is there any evidence to support the contention leading up to your self-defense argument that the victims or their group had weapons? I mean, not weapons, guns.
Other than that circumstance of Carrie Tibbett-Sheward finding the three different kinds of shells or casings, no. I mean, the gang members, none of them were testified that there was more than one gun discharged at the scene.
And I understood from the record that the judge intended to give a limited instruction. One was available. It just wasn't given. Is there any explanation for that? No objection appears to have been made by the defense. The prosecution would have,
you know,
I assume, thought the judge was going to give it. The judge didn't give it.
I don't have an explanation for that. I mean, we have a motion in limine that's brought two times to keep out this gang evidence. It's hard for me to imagine that there's an intentional waiver of the limiting instruction. Certainly there's nothing in the record that says that, but I fall back on Meek and Tavares in that line of cases. I think the trial court has the duty to give it, unless there's an affirmative waiver on the record, which in this case there's not.
Okay.
Now, thank you. With respect to the jury instruction on self-defense, I'm particularly targeting instruction number 32, which you find on page 2058. That's the instruction that uses the language absolutely necessary under the circumstance. And my question is whether that instruction has any bearing anymore in light of Culberson and Runyon, but also Pineda following Culberson. I submit it does not. Now, I would anticipate one of you would tell me, well, that jury instruction could be construed to mean that the appellant's belief is of the absolute necessity of use of deadly force. However, that's not how the trial prosecutor argued it or the trial judge construed it. And you see that at pages 1961 and 2002 of the record. The trial prosecutor was arguing that self-defense is an objective standard. The trial judge was agreeing, and that comes from the absolute necessity language. Now, here's the problem. The absolute necessity language is in a statute, 200.200(1), which is still there, still on the books. And it was discussed in some length in Runyon. But the Runyon result, although in dicta this court gave an example of jury instructions that could be used with the caution that you have to tailor to the facts and left absolute necessity in there, did not return to absolute necessity in Pineda. And in this case, it makes a profound difference. The argument that the state can make, and they kind of made it in these words at page 2002, is look, sure, Barajas swung the bat. Sure, a bat is a deadly weapon when it's swung at another human being. Sure, it hit Looney, but there's no evidence that Looney was injured. There's no evidence that Looney drew blood. Was it absolutely necessary to fire a gunshot at that point? No, it wasn't. The discharger of the weapon jumped the gun, so to speak. He doesn't enjoy self-defense under the absolute necessity standard. But frankly, the facts of this case, I think, better lend themselves to self-defense even than Pineda or Culberson or even Runyon, and yet the court, this court reversed the convictions on all three of those based on improper self-defense jury instruction. Now, if only jury instruction number 33 is given, which is taken directly from Pineda, we have no problem with number 33. We say that based on number 33, a reasonable jury should acquit with respect to Barajas, arguably could acquit as to Anguiano because of the profound evidence of the violence of the SSL. If that instruction is given, we think a different result reasonably could follow, and that's why we say that is reversible error. Finally, with respect to the proximate causation and transferred intent instruction,
if we did that, does that require a clarification of Runyon?
I think it does. I think it further requires a
How would you do that? How would you articulate that clarification?
I would articulate it this way, as I said in the reply brief. 200.160 sub 1 was the last statute that emanates back to the Nevada compiled laws days on self-defense that was amended. It was amended post-Culberson. It does not have the absolute necessity language therein. 200.200 sub 1 still on the books does. 200.160 allows for the subjective intent defense. 200.200 sub 1 on its face is purely an objective standard. I think the way you do that is you say 200.200 sub 1 was repealed by implication, much as this court did in 2001 in the Washington case. And that would be the position that I advocate. Now, with respect to the proximate cause instruction, and I grant Mr. Plater's position, my opening brief was not as clear as it should have been on this. Why are we giving a proximate cause instruction in this case at all? Proximate cause instruction would apply to a gang-on-gang type of scenario, which this is not. If it's a gang-on-gang scenario where both gangs have bad blood against each other, it's difficult to say anybody is, it's difficult to say that no one is the initial deadly aggressor. They're all the deadly aggressors, and for that reason, the proximate causation instruction works to that fact pattern. If somebody is hit by friendly fire, or if somebody's aiming a gun at person A but hits person B, as a matter of societal response, it doesn't matter. You are the proximate cause. In this case, though, it's not gang on gang. There's no evidence that my client shot Barajas or Anguiano intending to shoot somebody else. And what these instructions did, especially by not cross-referencing self-defense, is they set up somewhat of a vicarious liability. If you shoot a gun into a crowd, you're guilty. Proximate cause is really a defense, and when you give an instruction on a defense, which is not a defense, what you really do is you weaken the state's burden of proof because you make it look like somebody's running with the defense is running with a phony defense. In this case, and you see this at Appellant's Appendix 1975, trial counsel, I think kind of cleverly, argued that it's possible that Anguiano was hit by a bullet other than my client's, but the defense is self-defense and defense of others. I think she did that in order to stop the prosecutor from championing instructions 22 and 27. I have a minute and a half. I'll reserve. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cornell. On behalf of the respondent, Mr. Plater.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joe Plater for the state of Nevada. Let's take this issue about whether the district court correctly instructed the jury about self-defense. Now, the argument made by DeSantiago originally in his opening brief was that the trial court did not correctly instruct the jury when it told the jury that a defendant must actually believe that it's absolutely necessary to use self-defense. And DeSantiago, in his opening brief, argues that this language, absolutely necessary, is nowhere to be found in the Runyon case. And so the court should have never given that type of instruction to the jury. And that's just wrong. That language is expressly approved by this court in Runyon in the sample instructions the court gives. We talk about the fact that the defendant must actually believe that there's an imminent danger, and he must believe it's absolutely necessary to use deadly force. That's the argument that he made in his opening brief. And the reason he made that argument, he said, is that if we use the language absolutely necessary, it negates the idea of apparent danger. So it takes away a defense of apparent danger. That's not true either. This court said that when a defendant is entitled to the concept or the defense, self-defense instruction, the court can instruct the jury that either actual danger or apparent danger may justify the use of self-defense. The court explicitly said that in Runyon. And it went over, it did so in reviewing the common law history of self-defense and in reviewing the statutory authority in this case, and then finally resolving all of that and coming up with a sample instruction saying the defendant can use both concepts if the facts justify that. And that's what this court, the district court, did in this case. It instructed the jury that absolute, it must be absolutely necessary for the defendant to believe there is an imminent danger in order for him to use self-defense, or that apparent danger. There's a separate instruction, instruction I believe is 33, said that the jury could use apparent danger to justify self-defense for the defendant. So that's the argument that he originally made in his opening brief, and it's just wrong on the law, it's wrong on the facts, it's wrong according to the jury instructions the district court gave. Now he changes his argument. His argument in the reply brief is completely different. It's a brand new argument. It wasn't made in the district court, wasn't made in the opening brief, but now the argument is, well, the state of Nevada really doesn't mean to use the absolutely necessary language in self-defense instructions, even though that's exactly what you said in Runyon. And his rationale is that let's look at these other cases. Let's look at Harkins, and let's look at the other one is Pineda. And he says if you look at those cases, the jury instructions that are issued don't mention the language absolutely necessary. I submit this is very misleading, this argument, because in Harkins, what Mr. DeSantiago does is he cites one of the proposed jury instructions that both the state and the defendant wanted on self-defense that was based on Runyon. And the district court refused that proposed instruction that both parties wanted and that was based on Runyon. And he argues that in Harkins, this court did not note any absolutely necessary language in the instruction that that was given. But if you go back to Harkins and you look at the proposed instruction that both parties wanted, it was only a partial instruction on self-defense. That instruction only addressed apparent danger. And in fact, this court said, quote, foremost, the district court also gave the jury additional instructions from Runyon. So this court in no way in Harkins said, we're going to get rid of the absolutely necessary language that we've traditionally used in self-defense instructions, because it only was focusing on one particular part of the self-defense instructions. It doesn't come close to an abandonment of what you held in Runyon is can be used in self-defense instructions. And then in Pineda, which he also says is a signal from this court that we're not going to use the absolutely necessary language anymore, in that case, the court held there was reversible error not to give the defendant's proposed instruction on apparent danger, because that's available to a defendant if the facts justify it. And the court noted that the proposed instruction was consistent with apparent danger in Pineda. And then it set forth the instruction in a footnote, the proposed instruction that the defendant wanted in Pineda and that was refused. And that instruction was taken from Runyon. And then he goes on to argue, but there's no language in that footnote, sample instruction, of absolute necessity. But then again, the court wasn't giving all the sample instructions from Runyon in that footnote. And so there was no indication in Pineda either that the court intended to abandon that concept, that the defendant must believe that it's absolutely necessary to use self-defense.
Now, what are the facts in this case that warranted the giving of jury instruction number 32, in your view, Mr. Plater?
So 32 was the instruction that...
Absolute necessary language.
Well, that was an instruction that the defendant was requested and that he got. What facts would support that instruction?
I mean, my impression is that these self-defense instructions are given in the alternative, or if there are facts that support both, then they're given.
Right.
The argument seems to be that instruction 32 shouldn't be given because of the use of that language, that we should revisit Runyon where it permitted it. My question is further than that. What were the facts that justified giving that instruction as well as the apparent danger instruction?
Let me back up. That language that the defendant must believe that it's absolutely necessary, that's statutory language, as you know. That's that's the state, that's black letter law in the state of Nevada. And in Runyon, the court noted that. And it also noted that some of the statutory language provides for an apparent danger defense. And it said, you know, we're going to read all of these statutes congruously with the common law. And so, therefore, we think that both states of possible self-defense are applicable given the facts of a particular case. So that's where we get the language from. It's both from common law and the statutory interpretation of the state. Now, as to this particular case, there was evidence that Mr. DeSantiago put on that the aggressors in this case were members of the SSL gang and that they came looking for a fight and that they were armed. And there was even testimony that the first shot came from the group of SSL gang members. That one of them had a bat and swung at one of the other opposing rival gang members. Given if those facts were to be believed, that the SSL people came with a gun and they fired first and that they swung a bat at one of the other rival gang members, then there would be a situation where there would be an actual danger to perhaps the Mr. DeSantiago, and he'd be justified in using self-defense. Does that answer your question?
Yes, sir.
But, of course, the jury is the trier of facts. And there were also facts that the first shot was fired by not the SSL, but by Mr. DeSantiago. And he was the first one to fire shots, and he did so in reaction to Mr. Barajas giving him a gang sign signal. In the language of one of the witnesses, Mr. Barajas threw up his SSL sign. And it was at that moment that Mr. DeSantiago started firing his pistol, killed two people, and hit another person. So that would not justify, under those facts, if they were accepted by the jury, an actual danger scenario that would justify the use of self-defense. Now, as to the introduction of into evidence of the gang affiliation of the various players in this case, Mr. DeSantiago, you have to remember, took the stand and testified. He testified that he was on high alert when he saw these rival gang members approach him. And he testified that he was carrying a semi-automatic pistol because of his past altercations with the SSL gang. And he said that he knew, it was his knowledge, that the SSL gang had been armed in the past. He said that they were armed in this circumstance. So when he testified, he was trying to put forth facts of why he actually believed that his life was in danger, that he was justified in using self-defense.
Mr. Plater, how does that apply to the precipient witnesses who were his colleagues for that evening? Why is their gang affiliation relevant?
Okay. So Mr. DeSantiago was a member of the IS gang, the infamous soldiers gang. There were other people at this residence who were members of other gangs. And the point of their gang affiliation being relevant is that all of these gangs, whether it was Mr. DeSantiago's gang or the affiliation of the other gang members with him, they were all rivals to the SSL gang. In other words, the group of people who were coming to the house. So if Mr. DeSantiago and all of his associates are members of different gangs, but they're all rival gangs to the SSL, we now understand the context and the motive of why Mr. DeSantiago felt he had to either defend himself or his associates. It's because this rival gang is approaching, and apparently they want trouble, and they have weapons, and they mean to do us harm. So if he knows that his associates are rivals to the other gang, that provided him the motive in his mind to shoot, because he thought that his own life and the life of his associates were in danger because of this rivalry. So he wanted to present evidence. It was part of his defense to show that he knew this rival gang was approaching, and he had had dealings with them in the past. That's why he was carrying an automatic pistol. That's why he felt he was on high alert when he saw these people approach and when he saw Mr. Barajas give him a rivalry gang signal. Now, he doesn't get to present that evidence to justify his use of self-defense and at the same time say, well, the state's not permitted to present the whole context of the situation. Because if we present evidence of this rival gang, we are now presenting evidence of the context of how this happened. And that's important for the jury to understand. They should know these facts in order to resolve his claim of self-defense, because it gets into his thought process of what he was thinking when he saw these rival gang members.
Are you arguing that he waived affirmatively the requirement of a limiting instruction and did so strategically? Is that where you're going with
this?
Well,
I can't say that there was a strategic waiver because the...
So you concede that there was an error in not giving the limiting instruction?
No. Our first position is this isn't even bad act evidence.
Okay.
Now, Mr. Cornell's argument is that whenever you introduce bad act evidence or whenever you introduce gang association evidence, that is per se bad act evidence. It's prohibited character evidence, and we disagree. Because not all gangs are criminal gangs. Not all gangs have nefarious purposes. Not all people in gangs are necessarily criminals or do criminal things or have criminal intents. There's a lot of different gangs out there. Some motorcycle gangs have laudable purposes. They do a lot of good for the community. They raise money. So just the fact that you label somebody as being a member of a gang is not in and of itself bad character evidence. It is evidence that you're associated with a group of people. Maybe it's evidence of some status. What 48045 prohibits is using an act to prove character and that you acted in conformity with that character. We can't use it as propensity evidence. So we don't know. The bad acts that were introduced here were bad acts of the SSL gang, not bad acts of Mr. DeSantiago or necessarily of his gang. So that's why we think it should just be analyzed under a traditional probative value versus prejudice under 48035.
So you would say the failure to give a limiting instruction is immaterial?
It's immaterial. If it was required, we argue it was harmless. It was harmless because there's overwhelming, we think, evidence of his guilt. He shot. There is evidence the jury could have used and concluded that he was the first one to fire, Mr. DeSantiago, and he did it when he saw Mr. Barajas give him the gang sign from his rival gang, and that he then shot Mr. Alonzo and killed him on the spot. Mr. Alonzo wasn't armed, wasn't doing anything to provoke anybody to react by having him shoot at him. And then what's really important is that after he shot and killed Alonzo, he chased down the other two people and shot him in the back. He shot Barajas in the back of the head and killed him. And then he shot Garcia in the back, didn't kill him. But this is evidence that he certainly wasn't acting in self-defense. So the lack of a limiting instruction would have been harmless if it was required.
Thank you, Mr. Plater.
Thank you.
Mr. Cornell, because Mr. Plater had about 25-plus seconds, I'll add that time to yours as well in rebuttal.
Okay, thank you very much. In my view, answering Justice Hardesty's question or concern, any way you look at it, jury instructions 32 and 33 are inconsistent, and unsurprisingly, the trial prosecutor stressed instruction 32 in his successful closing argument to the jury. And what was that argument? It's not absolutely necessary. Why? Because at the time that Barajas hits Looney with the baseball bat, all we have is a mere fear. We don't have absolute necessity at that point. Yet, there's nothing in this record to indicate that Barajas would have stopped under any circumstance at one hit of Looney. The evidence is compellingly to the contrary that Barajas, but for the gunshots, would have kept going. Quite frankly, I considered raising an issue of insufficient evidence as a matter of law on Barajas only because of perfect defense of others. I decided not to because of this issue of absolute necessity and the proposition that the trial prosecutor, if he has construed the law correctly, would be correct. I don't believe he has. Referencing the limiting instruction, I'm still not understanding the relevance of Tiny and Looney's gang affiliation. I'm conceding that there's more relevance to my client's gang affiliation, but remember, why he comes to this neighborhood armed is not because he's a member of the infamous Soldiers who wants to have a gangbang, if you will, with the SSLs, because the last time he was in that neighborhood, he was attacked by the SSLs in a church and at a relative's home. And to say that membership in a street gang is not covered under 48045, I strongly disagree. I think this court has settled that issue numerous times. Lara v. State, Lay v. State, Pineda, it absolutely is. An act under 48045 does not have to be a crime. The act of joining a criminal gang implicates 48045. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cornell. Thank you, Mr. Plater. These matters will stand submitted. And we will allow a few moments in between arguments for the next argument and its advocates to move up to the tables.